Just a quick word before we start episode 2 to say sponsorships are available if anybody would like to discuss. Get in touch with me, John Bruford, by all the usual channels. Enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to Addiction, an hour with Hour. I am not Michael Hour. I'm John Bruford. But my co-host is Dr. Michael Hour, who I just mentioned. Dr. Hour, hello.
Hello, and I wasn't aware I'm co-host here. I thought I'm the star.
Yeah, that's totally what I meant. That was implied, because your name's on the billboard. And I'm just here to grease the wheels. I'm just here to make things happen for you.
Yeah, you're the one person they really understand. Linguistically. <Yeah.
laughs> That's it, yeah. I'm here as a translator. as long as all you say is, get to the chopper, then we're fine.
Only in the end.
So we're joined this episode of Addiction by Simo Dragicevic, who is a co-founder of AirHub Research Lab at UNLV, and stop me if I'm wrong. And Simo, we first spoke because you did the project with Sarah Ramanauskas, a similarly fantastic surname. And we were just mentioning before we're recording that the Game Safety Institute is no more. Do you mind talking about that for a minute? Would that be okay?
Yeah, sure.
Just puts the finger right in.
look, I personally had a sort of big passion in this space, as you know, and having worked at Playtech for 4 years, which is a game developer, really got into the nuts and bolts and really feel that there's an area of the industry that's under-researched and doesn't have a lot of focus, which is sort of game safety. And Sarah had that vision as well and that passion, and we tried to develop something and raise this as an issue and an opportunity across the industry. And, you know, for a number of reasons, didn't quite work. Maybe I'm, you know, looking to see progress a bit quicker than, say, when I did BetBuddy all those years ago. Maybe the industry's not ready to start people lifting up the lid and looking at the products in more detail. Maybe they're a bit wary, given all the other regulatory demands and compliance demands. So a lot of factors at play that just felt that it sort of remained a bit of an R&D project rather than a fully blown product and service. And that's not to say...
I don't think anybody would disagree with the idea.
Hmm.
But it's getting the right people buying into it, isn't it? I mean, it's like saying, you know, do you like kicking puppies? I mean, everybody's going to say no to that because it's a horrible idea. But that doesn't mean that they don't kick puppies. This isn't my best analogy, by the way.
I don't get it.
I'm struggling as well.
It works up here in my head, and that's the only important place.
If you kick your puppy, I'll come kick you.
See? Well, I don't kick puppies. But it's like you present an idea like Game Safety Institute to look at the environment of the game, you know, everything around the game, all the ancillary things and how a player plays, et cetera, in a way that hasn't been done before. And you know, businesses are going to be like, well, we're already compliant, so what do we need to do this for or whatever, because it's not a requirement. And as you say, you know, compliance departments are busy, full, often underfunded and understaffed. And it's kind of, I think it's maybe too soon or
and not also
recognized as valuable enough.
Possibly. Maybe it needs an industry approach rather than, say, an operator approach, because no one these days likes to put their head above the parapet and really do something. I can't think of a good example in the last few years where someone's gone above and beyond and really done something a bit different. So this kind of needs a bit of an industry focus, and that in itself is hyper complex, where you have to work with trade associations and lots of different operators and suppliers, and that that's probably needed. I feel there's a huge opportunity to replicate what other industries have done. I use the auto industry as a really good example of where product safety is just ingrained in the product and people like it, it's useful. It even saves lives, and you know, it's just become a huge part of innovation in that industry. And maybe it's a little bit early, and you know, this will come full circle again, and but we'll see.
Hopefully, it won't be too long. I won't be sitting around as a very, very old man and saying, you know, when somebody comes up with a similar idea, oh, I remember the Game Safety Institute. I remember when all this was Game Safety Institute. But we'll see.
But Simo, maybe, you know, we can talk a little bit first about yourself and your journey, because we know each other for sure for about 15 years, I guess. Like maybe 2010, 2011, I remember we've been to British Columbia to the New Horizons conference together. I think that was in 2012. Mm-hmm. So how did you actually come into this field? Like, how did you start within the gambling industry? And, you know, what did you do then?
Yeah, no, you're right. It is about 15 years. And I actually remember what Necton was called before it was called Necton, because it was Gamtrak, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Those were the really Gamtrak, early days. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So 2010, I think 2011. And I came into it because I was introduced to the industry by a friend who was working for one of the big suppliers, GTEC G2, which became part of GTEC, which then became part of IGT.
No, it's called Brightstar.
Brightstar, correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and it was the original, I guess, one of the originals, PlayScan, who pitched their product to GTEC G2, who were a large supplier to lotteries, probably back in 2008, 2009. And you know, he was like, you know, see, it was really interesting. There's this company who pitched us today. They're doing the complete opposite of what everyone's doing. You know, they're using data and neural nets to try and predict problem gambling. And I was at a point in my career, my background prior to gambling was consulting at Anderson Consulting, Accenture, investment banking, and managing sort of tech and regulatory projects in financial services. And I'd kind of hit a little bit of a glass ceiling at Barclays where I was. I was doing an MBA at the time. I was looking for something different. I was, you know, immersed with other entrepreneurs and ideas. And this really just seemed something very interesting to sort of work together and try and sort of get this off the ground. And it was a real labor of love, as you know, Michael. It sort of, you know, the industry, absolutely, a little bit like GSI, was not ready for BetBuddy or Necton or even PlayScan. It was a very small group of state lotteries that were pushing this idea. And I think it's fair to say it was quite a political play. You know, there were a lot of monopolies. There was a strong argument with some of the state lotteries that they, you know, the commercial sector couldn't protect the player as well as them, and they would use things like PlayScan as proof that they were going above and beyond. And it took, we sort of chipped away at it. I think you had a different business. You were doing traditional analytics and marketing analytics, so you had other avenues, whereas I was kind of pushing this as a sole business. And in the end, I think, luckily, you know how it is in business, is a fine line between success and failure, and it's a combination of things. And I think it was when Sarah Harrison became the head of the Gambling Commission here, she really shook up the industry. And, you know, the initial £7 million fine for 888 was followed with others. And then all of a sudden, the product market fit of something like BetBuddy kind of became apparent. You know, there was a need to do more. And it was a tough journey. You know, there were a lot of times I was going to jack it in. But in the end, sort of stuck it out. And we were a good fit for Playtech in the end, you know, sort of culturally, product-wise. They were sort of headquartered in the UK and had a bunch of customers here and saw the potential of it. So
if listeners are wondering what we are talking about, we're talking about the identification and prediction of potentially problem gambling in online gambling settings or land-based gambling if players are identified. That's how it, you know, started. And I think Mark Griffiths, he mentioned this, you know, possibility even back in the late 90s when he said, you know, online gambling operators can actually use the data to find indications of problematic gambling if they, you know, check computer metrics like session time, depositing frequency, and all that kind of stuff. And now it's more or less, you know, a household requirement in many jurisdictions that operators at least, you know, apply their own algorithms to compute a problem gambling related risk.
And it's interesting you mentioned Mark Griffiths, because when I first started BetBuddy, I was sort of looking, you know, I was new to the space. So I was trying to find who are the people who know this stuff. And I was looking for academics. And the three that really came up as the sort of the ones I needed to speak to was Mark Griffiths, Alex Blazinski, and Howard Schaefer. Yes. And I contacted them all as a nobody with no background in gambling and research. And Mark immediately responded with all his papers and said, I'm really busy, but hey, read these. Great. Howard Schaefer responded, and I've never met Howard. I know he's recently retired, and there's a lot of respect for him as an academic, but he wasn't that thrilled with what was on my website and what I was proclaiming to do, and didn't really help.
Okay.
But Alex Blazinski said, yeah, let's have a conversation. And, you know, I gave me an hour of his time, which I thought was really cool. Sort of built a nice friendship with him. So yeah, no, it's interesting. Mark, you're right, was, you know, one of the sort of academic sort of pioneers in that space, you could argue.
Yeah, yeah, all three of them retired. Yeah, no, I'm very fortunate that he was so supportive of my work and, you know,
publishing. He really does tolerate you, doesn't he?
Yes. Every paper, every draft I sent him, he completely rewrites it within 4 hours or something like that. He's like a living AI, paper machine AI. So, but what do you think? Like, I mean, I'm not sure how you know, how closely you're monitoring this process, because I'm still, you know, doing what I always did, you know, I mean, with Necton and Mentor. But what do you think? I mean, in your opinion, how did this change? Let's say, go rewind the clock to 2012, now 2025. Well, I mean, in terms of responsibility, in terms of duty of care, do you feel that regulation has changed and or operators' attitudes have changed?
Yeah, for sure. You know, when we started, you know, we were not that welcome, were we, really? There weren't that many people who were willing to see the product. They thought it was kind of voodoo magic, sort of machine learning and neural nets and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit like that, wasn't it? It really was a black box, and they truly knew how it worked. But no, for sure, the industry has been on a journey and has evolved and is a very different place than what it was when I first started. Not to say that it's still doing things as it should be. I feel there are still lots of areas it can improve. I feel this discipline, the use of data to detect risky play and problematic play, feels to me, I'm a little bit out of the detail last 4 years, Michael, as you know, I left Playtech. So
it feels
like it's plateaued a bit as a, and you know, you could tell me otherwise, as an area or a discipline in terms of has anything really new or fundamental been released in its products in the last few years? Or has it been more around just more adoption of the tech that was developed, say, 5, 10 years ago? Obviously, in parallel, we've had this huge, massive investment in generative AI and AI in general now, and that's got a bit of a hockey stick trajectory. My feeling is, and again, I'm interested in your thoughts, is that we've plateaued a bit, and I haven't seen anything really new. And I don't know whether that's because it's more of an adoption phase we're in rather than a sort of an R&D innovation phase.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you. I mean, what, you know, the question I'm asking myself is, because, you know, people throw around terms like, okay, predicting problem, blah, blah, blah. But then at the end of the day, what's actually the goal here? And, you know, from a marketing perspective, it's really easy, right? You want to make more money, right? I mean, like, you know, you feed the AI and let's say we had, you know, an all, you know, all intelligent, whatever, you know, AI, we'd say, okay, look, we want maximum amount of money from an individual and or let's say maximum lifetime, whatever, you know, customer relationship, it's easy. But with respect to responsible gaming, the question, you know, the target variable, the outcome variable is not so easy to define because what do I actually want to achieve? Do I want, you know, people to spend within their limits, right? Do I want, you know, people to sort of feel good about their gambling? Do I want to have, you know, casual gambling, you know, low spend per day, whatever, you know, what's the outcome variable? Because as we all know, I mean, you can never tell, and that's also something, you know, which annoys me personally often that, you know, suppliers or whatever, you know, wannabe, you know, experts talk about problem gambling, you know, and we cannot identify a problem gambler from a clinical point of view because problem gambling is something that's not just related to losing money, but also it's about, okay, am I criticized for my gambling? Do I feel bad about my gambling? All those kinds of things. And you can never tell whether a person who gambles online actually is a problem gambler from a clinical point of view. So you can always, you know, just find indications. But, and that's, I think, also something where you see regulators somehow, you know, are drifting apart. That's what I feel, you know. If you look at the UK, if you look at Germany, if you look at Spain, then you see that the regulators follow a quite different approach.
Yeah. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's a clinical definition, and we've always struggled to have really good data sets to build, like the type of algorithms that can really accurately pick out problem gamblers or disordered gamblers, you know. So it has to be a more watered-down version, which is kind of pattern matching, you know, populations of interest, people that we can interact with, people that we can nudge. And that's something that's kind of taken a while for people to understand. And, you know, I was probably guilty, you know, in the early days, you know, we would proclaim to
define,
you know, and that's probably why Howard Schaefer, you know, had a fit with me. And you know, but that's fine. You learn as through the process, exactly, and, you know, with the data and the art of the possible. But what I would say is that shouldn't stop the industry or, you know, people like yourself to keep pushing the boundaries and using the data because it is really useful. And it is a great way to sort of build player profiles and understand behaviors and try and build a, you know, an entertainment experience that keeps people, as you say, in that, whatever that target variable is, which exactly. You know, maybe AI will be more intelligent, will be able to help achieve, you know, in future in a more sophisticated way.
Did you hear about the Spanish regulators' plans?
Yes, that was
rolling.
That was
in, yeah.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, I've got a few thoughts on that. So for context, is the Spanish regulator, I don't know the detail, but is planning to sort of deploy its own solution or algorithm, whatever you can call it, which looks at play across all licensed operators and will assign risk scores.
No, it's not like that. It's every operator will
apologies.
Their model. And, you know, compute the risk score as specified by the model, by the formula that they will receive from the Spanish regulator in a JSON format. JSON, you know, it's like a technical format, like XML.
So then what, the regulator will supply a solution for each operator?
No, not a solution. So obviously, I mean, that's how I understand. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but I don't think so. So the regulator obviously developed a model. So they really collected problem gambling severity index responses from actual players from various platforms, obviously, correlated this with player behavior. I mean, this is how it's meant to be. That's also, I mean, I published two papers with that methodology, and they have a model, right? You know, and the model is based on, so what's happening is, so somebody plays, they gamble, they bet, they whatever, gender, age, and then you apply a formula, more or less, where every variable is then weighted, you know, multiplied by weight, and you receive a score. And that score is the propensity for self-reported problem gambling.
Okay.
However, so they did this, but I've been to Bern like yesterday and 2 days ago, and I met a guy from the Spanish Lottery, and he said they asked for their authorities, but they wouldn't disclose anything. Where they did it, who did it, whatever. You know, like for example, accuracy numbers or goodness of fit statistics, area under the curve, Nagel, KR, whatever, you know, stuff is out there, nothing. And then they really send out a document with, so there's, it's based on 61 variables. Amongst them are simple to compute variables like age and gender. But they're also very complicated variables like median, deviation of the loss over the last 30 days and stuff. So, and what's happening is in machine learning, when you compute a variable slightly different to what it's been computed during the training set, then the outcome is way off. It's like pointing a telescope, you know, on Jupiter, and you're off by a very small, you know, a fraction of an angle, and then, you know, your telescope points towards Saturn. You know, it's completely off. Yeah. And that's what, but you know, and there's I wrote a response. I have to still submit it. That's what I think will be very difficult for them to roll out, because every operator will come up with a result, no question asked, right? You compute those 61 variables, you come up with a result, but the outcome will be catastrophic. because everybody will come up with an outcome. Okay, you know, they will score their players, but this score will mean something entirely different than what was actually intended to happen. And the thing is, they also specify once the score is larger than 0.36 or something like that, this player is a risky player, and then operators have to take an action, you know, ban them from all advertising and stuff. And I don't know how many licensed operators there are in Spain, but I think it's many. And imagine everybody will then, you know, have questions, and, you know, this will completely overwhelm the regulator with inquiries.
Yeah. I mean, I have some thoughts. I mean, I agree with all of your concerns, Michael, in terms of the practicalities, especially 61 input. And if some of them are derived from, you know, as you said,
complex variables,
makes things a bit harder because everyone's data is slightly different, and you know what is a session, what is a bet, you know, how they get revenue.
Yes.
Everyone does it slightly differently in their back offices. So definitely there's a potential complexity there. I feel why are they doing it is an interesting question. And I think the industry has a bit of a transparency issue in terms of it's been saying, you know, trust us, we're using...
I see where you're going.
Yeah.
That's the reason why they do it, you know?
Yeah. So one of the issues is like, well, you're telling us you're doing this, you're doing that, you know, you're using Necton, BetBuddy, Mindway, etc. But, you know, we're not seeing the results or the outputs of the evaluation or the reduction in harm or problem gambling. And maybe there's also a little bit of, you know, maybe, again, I'm not with the Spanish regulators, but maybe when they do the audits and reviews of some operators, they've looked under the hood and they've probably not been impressed with what they've seen. You know, maybe there are some very simplistic rules-based spreadsheets there that are, you know, kind of wrapped up as AI or machine learning or advanced that don't really do that much or only flag, say, you know, 0.1% of the player base for an email notification. So that's probably the extreme, but that probably does happen in reality. So I can see they're potentially being forced to say, look, well, you know, you've had a few years to do this and we don't trust you, or we don't see the best practice, so we're going to step in and we're going to do it for you. Now, I don't necessarily think that's the right approach. I feel that there's potentially something in between, which is, how do the operators, how do the industry demonstrate the best practices, the transparency, how the models were developed, the, as you mentioned, the results, the accuracies, the areas under the curve, you know, false positive, false negative rates. So bring all that to the fore so you can see what good looks like. And then that can inform whether the regulator is confident or whether it needs to sort of do some deep dive with particular operators or particular systems. I don't believe that's happened, and I feel that's a missed opportunity rather than saying, okay, we can't trust you, we're going to do it, because, you know, I fear. So that's one area that sort of Kaz and I are working on at UNLV with AirHub, is to sort of try and build sort of templates and methodologies and tools that can help the industry showcase their work, their tooling in a more transparent way that builds sort of trust.
No, I think it's definitely a result of intransparency. Because, I mean, I, you know, had, of course, over the years, you know, I have conversations with operators, and often these conversations then end when they understand that they cannot influence an algorithm, right? When they can't say, hey, you know, I want to, you know, work on those gauges a little bit, you know? And that obviously happened in Spain, that some operators have whatever 1% high-risk players, the others have 0, the others have 5. And then regulators probably ask themselves, okay, why is this the case? They must have completely different approaches, or maybe they don't do anything at all. And they just, you know, assess, because they can assess the high-risk players the way they want it. And I know, you know, I mean, of course, you know, because why would you flag more high-risk players if you have, you know, commercial, if this is commercially negative for you, and that's what's happening. But we see this in other countries too, right? If you look at the Netherlands, in the beginning, it was, you know, pretty liberal. And then a number of those first adopters were advertised very aggressively, and there were a couple of cases of players losing really large amounts of money, and that's when they stepped in and then, you know, increased or restricted the advertising more and more and more, as a, you know, as a result of irresponsible actors.
It's interesting. I mean, I come from financial services, and one of the areas I worked on was sort of assessing risk in investment banks and how much capital you hold. And just bear with me on this. I think it's a nice analogy, where one of the ideas I pushed to people, and I remember talking to Sarah Harrison about it, saying, look, you know, in the banking sector, you know, what do investment banks want? They want to hold less capital, i.e. money, to set aside for sort of bad outcomes, because that money can be used to trade, to take educated investment decisions and make lots of money. So they want to do as much as that as they can. But then the regulators say, well, you know, you could screw up. You need to hold back some capital to cover your losses. Now, there are two ways they do it. The regulator sets out its benchmark and says, you'll use this method, this formula, and this is the capital you'll set aside for these types of lending and trading and business that you're in. Now, if you're in advance, so if you want to take more risk, you're allowed to use your own models, but you then have to demonstrate how you build them. You have to say, look, here's the data we used to stress test the models. Here are the results. We went back 10 years and looked at all these scenarios and all these economic ups and downs. And look, if this happened, this worst case scenario, you know, the model can handle it, and we've set aside the right amount of capital. And that's kind of interesting. So it's like the regulator's got the floor. You know, this is what we expect everyone to do. Now, if you want to be more aggressive, or if you want to be more sophisticated, you can do that. But there are certain conditions. You need to show us what you've done. And I feel like, again, the industry could follow a similar path, where it's like, okay, the regulator says, you know, here are the limits, or here's the system, or here are the restrictions. But look, if you're more sophisticated and understanding profiling and player behavior, you can have some more leeway. You know, people can spend more, deposit more, because you've got better systems and you've proven it. You know, you've disclosed how you've done it.
So, isn't the ECBA, you know, markers of harm specification one of these attempts were you involved there, or?
I wasn't. I'm kind of aware of it. I kind of see the point of it, you know, trying to sort of get some standardization around how you assess harm. I feel there were some good and there were some good points to it, and there were some problems with it. So I feel like sort of markers of harm vary based on the player and sort of kind of what you and what products they engage with. And the one example I always remember with my days at Playtech and BetBuddy was if we had one of the model inputs was deposit frequency or even just frequency, you know. And it was a good predictor for online casino harm. But for bingo, it was poor because it was such a normal behavior. People are always encouraged to sort of log in. There are sort of incentives to sort of come in and deposit a bit of money and play some bingo. So that marker of harm was completely different with sort of online casino than it did with, say, online bingo. So I feel like marks of harm are useful, but they probably need a bit more contextualization around them. But I see the point of it. I see where they're going with it. I just feel like it seemed a little bit too simplistic for me.
I mean, I agree with you, and it's very broad, right? So everybody, I mean, literally all of these dimensions, because, I mean, they are not like, you know, specified to the, you know, greatest detail, are usually part of any, you know, detection algorithm or risk assessment. So if an operator said, we don't use this, then it would like saying, I drive a car without wheels. You know what I mean? You have to take into account playing time. You know, you have to take into account losses, deposits. So it's very, very, very broad, you know. And the other way, for example, if you look at Germany, so in Germany, the regulator introduced a number of also markers or monitoring criteria. And as you, or maybe, you know, listeners, for context, it's important to mention that in Germany, in the beginning, when they introduced the online casinos, I mean, they call it actually virtual slot machines, so virtuelle Automatenspiele, not casino, you mustn't say that, because it's really just slots. Then players were only allowed to deposit 1,000 euros a month across all of the licensed operators, because the technologically really, you know, cool thing, heads off, is they have a system that's connects all of the operators. So whenever you deposit, right, the system will make a request with the limit database with an API, and they ask, okay, how much did Simo already deposit this month? Of course, I mean, has to make sure that they identify Simo. But let's say the KYC is so good that, you know, the Simo would always be Simo and identified through passport or whatever. But that's what's happening there. And then they started, you know, to based on, you know, industry pressure, because the offshore market is so large, players to increase the limit to 10K or something a month. I mean, nobody does that in reality, 10K, but at least, you know, deposit more than 1,000. And if players deposit more than 1,000, or let's say an operator can apply, hey, I want to, you know, increase, have some players increase the limit. And then they have to monitor them closer. So, and these are very specific criteria, you know, things like, how often did this guy play last 90 days? Does this guy deposit more than three times on average on a day? You know, does this guy, when they change the limit, do they exploit the limit within 3 days after changing it? You know, you could sort of change your limit after 3 days. You did like metrics like this. Still, there's a lot of, you know, room for interpretation, because operators interpret it differently. So there's lots of, you know, a certain degree of confusion. But they basically went down the route of very transparent criteria that every operator has to monitor. And if a number of these criteria apply for a player, they have to be reported into a database. And of course, the limit has to be, you know, reverted back to 1,000. But what I'm saying is, those are, you know, different approaches, right? And the regulator could say, this, you know, very specific. Or a regulator could say, just apply an algorithm, you know, we don't care. Or you have not a Spanish case where the regular says you apply an algorithm, but not yours, but you do ours, you know?
So that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think conceptually this idea that you have centralized limits kind of makes sense to me. I don't disagree with it. You know, like, you know, you can have a limit that's global and applies to all your accounts. And the idea that you can flex it based on your understanding of the player and the behaviors, you know, that all sort of conceptually makes sense to me, you know. So I don't know, I never really worked in the German market, so I don't know how it's been perceived. I've heard that, you know, so operators complaining it's a bit clunky, but look, you know, operators will always complain around compliance and restrictions.
Yeah, it will always be. Yeah. I mean, okay, the limitation there is surely that as an operator, you can only offer slots, so you can't have roulette, you can't have live roulette, you can't have blackjack, and that's a big piece of a typical online casino is missing here, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But you know, at least they can play slots in a legal environment now in Germany, and the government. I mean, the what they called it in the UK, single customer view, exactly, seems to be working quite okay technologically and in terms of the identification. Yeah, so what's it? I mean, you're more familiar with the UK, right? I mean, what's it like there? How would you describe it? And to what degree would you say it's different, let's say, from Spain that we just discussed, or Germany?
Yeah, the UK. So I did for the benefit of the listeners, I was on the digital advisory panel of the Great Britain Gambling Commission, or the UKGC, which everyone refers it to, for about 3 years. So I have some insight into how they're approaching regulation and some of these challenges. And I feel, they've obviously been trialing financial risk assessments, looking at, you know, using credit reference agency data to assess people's risk, financial risk and vulnerabilities when they approach certain deposit amounts. So I'm not too close to it. I know they released some results. I mean, it's quite a political thing that's been going on in the UK for several years. The whole, it was initially called affordability, now financial risk assessments. And I know the Gambling Commission is very interested in understanding the art of the possible. They're looking at open banking, which is this idea that, you know, players can voluntarily allow operators access to their bank accounts, so they can trawl through that data and make assessments based on financial risk. It's still in its early days, but I know the UK regulator is interested in the art of the possible there as well. So there is a single customer view, but it's run by the trade body, the BGC. I'm not that close to that. I know that if you were to think of the population, gambling population as a pyramid, it's probably right at the top of the pyramid. So it's probably, again, I can't say any numbers because I don't know, but it's probably a relatively small percent. It could be several of thousands of players. It could be a large number, but as a proportion of the population is probably quite small. But I know that operators are sharing information with regards to people who are known problem or disorder gamblers. So there are things happening on the single customer view, but nowhere near to the level of Germany, from what you explained. So I think there's still a bit of a gap there in terms of bridging this true single customer view. The UK has obviously gone through the whole white paper process. I think it's fair to say the industry is a bit jaded. I don't know how much appetite there is for new safer gambling, innovation and tooling and ideas. Certainly with the GSI, there was an interest, but not much of an appetite to sort of try and test. So maybe they're going to hit a bit of a plateau in terms of, you know, and I know the regulator is very keen on using data to help it regulate the industry. So there's a few pilot projects to try and pull in that industry data and really use it to sort of understand the market, how people are playing, where the potential risk areas are, evaluating some of the changes they're implementing. So maybe there's a period of, there's never a period of calm in the UK, but there's maybe a period of let's see what the data shows and how these changes are affecting the market. And you mentioned, you know, the black market or unlicensed gambling. It's clearly a real threat and a real thing, much bigger, obviously, in jurisdictions like Germany, but still, you know, probably growing in the UK and something I think the regulator probably in the last 2 years has taken much more seriously than it would have done previously, because obviously the UK had high channelization rates, probably still does, but they're probably under more pressure as, you know, younger generations and so many more gambling opportunities emerge on the internet that are just unregulated. It's an interesting, super complex environment to be a regulator at the moment. I think it's a very hard job.
I mean, what I like about the UK's approach is that they emphasize the interaction part, because for me, you know, what you ultimately should do is you should emphasize prevention. You know, detection is of course important, and there will always be problem gamblers because, you know, it's a bell-shaped curve. You know, you have people to the extreme, and that's gonna happen. You can never reduce it, down to zero. But you can emphasize on information, on reality check, on personalized feedback. You know, informing players about changes in play, etc. And these requirements are still very rare, you know, regulatorily. So very few regulators actually require operators to really notify players actively, not just the ones who, you know, you suspect have an issue. But in the UK, whenever there is an audit, and they do it in a way that they pick individuals who complain to them, about certain operators, so they know, you know, CMO played with this operator. Now let's go check, you know, let them show us what they did with him, you know. And then they really have to reach out to players. They have to provide evidence that this worked, you know, that they didn't know, or that the individual gave a reasonable response, or they had their, you know, relevant, you know, available income to be able to continue gambling like this. And that's something, you know, I always emphasize when, you know, I speak with regulators, that it's the player interaction, you know, the customer interaction. That's something you can really sort of specify, I would say, even maybe more logical, easier than, you know, the prediction part. Because you say, okay, what's the outcome? You know, what's the goal? The goal is, for example, for more players to have limits. For example, you know, in the US, like if you look at the large operators' reports, the only players who have a limit, that's in the single digit area. You know what I mean? Whereas somewhere else, like in Spain, you register as an individual, you have a limit, right? They give you a daily, a weekly, and a monthly limit, and you can change it. But everybody has a limit. And, you know, prompting players to set limits is easy. I mean, and we know this works really well. But if you don't do it, you know, if you just hide it somewhere, if you never bring it up, of course players will not set the limit. So these are very low-hanging fruits, but these low-hanging fruits are not really, you know, somehow in the regulatory focus.
You're right. It's probably because it's a little bit it's not that, you know, regulators like to be black and white. So you do this, you can do this, and you can't do this. So the interaction piece requires a bit of art and creativity and a bit of trial and error. And you know, I agree with you, fair play to the UK for pushing that, because it's not black and white. But clearly your data shows, is some of the data I remember from my days at Betbuddy and Playtech showed that, you know, intelligent prompting, which is based on the behaviors of the player and their setup, can make some changes. And I feel there's a whole world to explore as well with generative AI, agentic AI, this, you know, this new generation of people spending most of their time, you know, being digitally native, you know, always on phones and stuff. There's this opportunity to sort of do that in a better and more sophisticated way. And maybe that's what I'm looking for in terms of that innovation.
And all of this really happens in marketing, right? I mean,
They
don't care why somebody plays more, you know, they just want them to play more. And that's also something, you know, where I see, like, you know, resistance or a lot of, you know, friction that regulators and also, you know, operators, personnel, they want to understand things, but algorithms cannot be put into words. You know, I cannot, you know, ask my Tesla, why do you detect another car, right? I cannot call Elon Musk, explain the algorithm to me. You cannot explain a neural network. You can't explain a XG boost. You can't explain a complex, a random forest. You can't, right? I mean, you can sort of derive the most important variables or the variables it uses, the variables it ignores, but you can't put it, you know? And let's say you have an AI which says, you know, I create responsible play. I don't care how it does it, you know? It might message players, it might dynamically change the game, etc., etc. But we have, you know, the need to understand patterns, cause, effect, relationships. But as soon as you apply AI, or I mean, you can't ask ChatGPT, how do you work? How does this all work? You know, I mean, how do you know that stuff? Whatever, you know what I mean? This ship has sailed, you know, it has sailed. You just have to accept that it does what it does, you know.
You know, it's interesting. This thing, the EU AI Act is sort of, is interesting because it tries to add some structure to this whole space. And at the moment, it doesn't reference any gambling use cases. But if you think about how it defines AI, you know, they have this category called unacceptable risk,
which is basically
it's banned. You cannot deploy an AI that does this. But the terminology is quite broad, you know, talks about, you know, vulnerabilities and exploiting people. And if you then start thinking about that sophisticated marketing algorithm that has a goal, and the goal is to sort of, you know, increase deposits and increase engagement, how does it truly know that it's not, you know, doing that to somebody and sort of picking someone's vulnerability?
Yeah, it's
so
just,
I feel there's a murky area there that the industry is going to have to address at some point in the next few years. And I don't feel the industry is purposely doing it. I feel it's like many other e-commerce industries. What I think is it's not very good at explaining, and not to your point, Michael, not at a detail level, but in a broad level. These are the policies we have. These are the goals of our algorithms. This is how we ensure that the vulnerable person isn't targeted, because we use Necton. We have a safety net. You know, we have a policy that if Necton says this player is high risk, that I can't do this. I can't keep hitting them with deposit offers, you know. So it's that kind of transparency, I think, that we need to really instill into the industry.
Yeah. John, what do you think about it? You're so quiet. Something on your mind?
No, I am being really quiet. I am listening. It's just, I'm just not sure what I can bring to this conversation. There's an interesting point earlier that Simo made about how different player types playing different games creates an entirely different profile that doesn't fit in, and you use bingo players as an example. And I've offered, we were having a conversation about this earlier, Michael, and I was thinking about, you know, it's in so many ways, gambling is lumped into a great big group. And it's absolute bollocks, because every form of gambling is completely distinct. And I was thinking, we were talking about how the amount of time you spend is a significant factor in understanding somebody's play behavior. It's not necessarily how much they spend. It's like, if they spent 10 hours playing this, then it might not be great. But then I was thinking about, how the hell do you analyze it for poker players?
Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned is interesting, right? Because that's a question, you know, I'm asked often, you know, regularly. And on the one hand, if you sort of, you know, really reduce it to the bare essentials, we talk about gambling disorder. And if you look at the DSM-5 or the PGSI, it doesn't consider games at all, right? It's very broad. It's okay. Do I, you know, when I lose on a day, do I come back the next day to win back that money? But you could also chase within a session, or I don't know what, you know, you could chase that, you know, it's just, you know, a concept. And then, of course, with the different types of games, and you also have habits, you know, people in Spain are up longer, you know, they eat later in the evening. Mm-hmm. Nighttime gambling, it might not be such an issue, you know, as compared to Norway.
Older people as well.
Yeah, older people, you know, yeah, or you know, lots of differences. So the art here is really to not get lost in the detail. You know, it's a trade-off, right? You want to have criteria which are broad enough that they apply everywhere. And then on the other hand, it's.
But why can't you get lost in the detail? Because when you look at CRM software, it's all about granularity.
Yes. But the point then there would be or is that you don't care about what how it does it, but you just, you know, apply it, you know, you send it out into the world and it does its job, you know, if it has the correct training data, right? So if every operator provided the training data, so they, you know, had a sample of, you know, regularly asked players about their habits, because that's what you need to train it. You know, you can't train it just on self-exclusion. You need to train it on, you know, these criteria. Or you could also go and say, you know, I don't care about gambling disorder. I just want to prevent overspending. So, you know, I'll have a significant sample of players and I want to forcefully run the, you know, the open banking procedure, and the ones who are broke, you know, or don't pay their bills, those are the ones, you know, I want to identify. It always comes down to the fact, who are the ones I actually want to identify, and that's, you know, what I need. But that's not happening, you know, nobody does it, nobody has this information. And then you could basically lean back and say, hey, the AI trains the data based on the desired target variable, open banking, or, for example, default, you know, payment default could be another criteria, or psychological problems. But that's the tough part, right, to get hold of this information. Because this is like beating around the bush. You know, everybody talks about risk score. But in reality, it's all about actually the outcome that, you know, I need to train it. And nobody does it, you know, nobody has it. Nobody goes actually through this procedure, because then you can really, you know, detach from these general criteria, like you have in some cases. Okay, if somebody loses 5,000 euros over the last 30 days, you know, but I mean, 5,000 euros for John is different than 5,000 euros for Simo or 5,000 euros for me. You know what I mean? You know, if you had this data, then, you know, I mean, this outcome variables, which have to be collected because they are not part of a typical online gambling operator's data set, then you can do it. But that's not happening. Nobody does it. Nobody has this.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, typically machine learning algorithms have, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of, you know, use cases that you can train them on, image classification, for example. You know, we don't have that luxury, which makes the craft so much harder. You know, you'd ideally want to have access to lots of bingo players, lots of lottery players, the open banking data, everything. And then, you know, but it's really hard to get that. So, agree.
So Simo, like, I mean, we didn't touch on the subject at all so far, but let's, you know, go there a little bit on the structural characteristics,
yes,
right? Because
yes,
this is
yes.
something that totally bothers me, has been bothering me for a very long time, and I just, you know, don't have an answer here. What's your take on this? And maybe you can also give a bit context what we actually mean with structural characteristics.
Yeah, so The way I looked at products, I guess recently, you know, especially with sort of GSI, was to try and sort of look at elements that help define or describe the product. So if we take a slot, so for example, we had sort of I think five categories of descriptors. So you could have the mechanic, And these, by the way, this isn't a perfect model. It was never published or validated, but this is the sort of thinking. So you could look at mechanic, and then you could look at things like, you know, does it offer sort of persistence features? So the ability to sort of collect items as I play that have monetary value, so that, you know, you can get into it, which you can use in a different element of the game, say the bonus round. Does it have, you know, wins below the stake? What are the things, you know, does it have things like buy features? You know, can I circumvent the base game and go straight into the bonus round? Does it have a gamble feature? If I win something, can I immediately gamble and try and double that, you know, on the flip of a card? So these are what I sort of call the mechanic elements of a game that, you know, clearly if something, and the logic is, if something has a gamble feature, it's riskier. Because if I've just spun a pound and won £10 and it says, oh, double that to £20, you know, pick red or black, I know that the odds of that winning are much lower than, say, the RTP of the game. It's just the way it's designed. Mm-hmm. So that is a risky element. So if you start enticing people with gamble features, they're likely to lose what they've just won. So, you know, we would say that's a riskier mechanic in the game. The buy feature is an interesting one. Some really experienced lots of players just want to know what they're getting into. They want to sort of skip the boring part of the game and go into the bonus round, and they're prepared to pay. You know, the time is potentially important, is just as precious as the gameplay. So they say, I don't want to waste 10 minutes to get to this. I just want to get straight in there and play. So the mechanic, those mechanical elements of how the game's structured, could be the win lines, you know, is it a cluster play? Is it a 3x5? There are lots of other elements to the game as well, but I was looking at them from a risk perspective. And then we had like the platform. These are the things that in the UK have already been sort of banned or regulated out. So can you speed up the reels, turbo play? Can you automate the spin, autoplay? Yeah. Can you stop the reels, spin stops? In so many jurisdictions, that's still allowed. Clearly, you can see where there are some risky elements by speeding up and this illusion of control, the spin stop, which might be fun, but some people might think they can actually, you know, affect the outcome. I mean, that's really interesting when we think about crash games. If we have time, we can talk about that. And then you have the math profile. So RTP is the obvious, but no one really understands RTP. I think a really good test of somebody, if they really understand slots, is to give them a really simple question grounded around RTP to see if they really understand. Let's say a casino has a game, an RTP of 100%, and you go and play the game during the evening, you know, what's the likelihood of you achieving 100% or the casino making money? It's clearly going to be the casino, because we know RTP is calculated over, you know, billions of spins. And there's the volatility of the game, which again affects how much you have to put in to try and achieve the RTP and to reach various parts. And then we also had prize, you know, like not just the overall jackpot size, which we know is important to a certain point, but also are there like elements to it? Like, you know, do you time the jackpot? You know, will it pay out at a certain amount, or will it pay out at the end of the day? And that can really drive people into a game. We also looked at theme, but it was a bit flaky, the evidence around whether the theme is potentially risky. So these are all the elements that sort of make a lot of the elements that make up how the game works. And we tried to sort of distill it into a model that you could then sort of rank it and say, look, these games potentially are riskier because they have more bells and whistles and features, and they're faster, and you can speed things up and skip rounds. I feel it's an area that's, again, massively under research, but still highly relevant. It's unfortunate, I think, that my own personal view is I don't think banning them or banning these features is the right way forward, because I think in this sophisticated world we live in today, there are lots of offers outside licensed gambling where people can go and play slots with autoplay. You know, most people play on mobile phones. They don't want to sit there tapping the phone every time they want to slot. They have a budget. They have a number of spins. They probably just want to put it on autoplay. A lot of them do. So why ban that? when you could actually regulate it, have it as an option, but put some friction around it or some education around it. So I feel it's an area that really no one understands. It innovates very quickly in the industry. We talked about crash games, and it's just kind of left, and eventually a regulator comes along and just stops it because they think it's bad. And then that's good for the industry because they know where the rules are and they start innovating again within the rules. But then you get those offers in the illegal market. So I've talked a little bit there, but that's kind of, we can get into sports betting. It's a little bit more complicated because there's more element of skill and experience and the type of sport and the odds. It's a fascinating area. And I feel we're missing a trick as an industry by not addressing the sort of elephant in the room, which is, you know, how do we educate people to play these games in a more intelligent way to ensure it's entertaining?
My last question, do you think, I mean, I have my personal opinion on this, but do you think that game developers have a clear strategy in terms of what, you know, will work or not? Or do you think this is a lot about feeling, about trend, and about knocking off what worked before, you know? Because, yeah. I mean, you have, for example, you have certain games, I won't, you know, name them, from certain suppliers that have been popular for decades. And people still play them, although they are might appear outdated or, you know, very simple compared to contemporary games. And I have the feeling this has a lot to do with brand, you know, because as a kid, you know, I mean, you learned about car brands and now you perceive certain car brands as, you know, more luxurious than others because this was ingrained into your brain over decades of, you know, advertising and branding. And with casino games, with slots, it's very similar, you know, because players learn that certain games have paid out or are popular because you simply see these machines everywhere. Depends a bit, you know, on the region, whether you are in US, in, you know, Austria, Germany, or whether, you know, Spain or in the UK. And I have the feeling these games just are, you know, all-time evergreens, favorites. And then there are a lot of similar games that are created with very similar, you know, themes. It's mostly the theme then, right? That, you know, they feel is then popular. Or do you think, on the other hand, that a game studio says, now, you know, we create this game, we know that this has this impact, we have the super AI, and the super AI is gonna, you know, create now the you know, the whatever blockbuster game. What do you think? How does this work?
I'm with you. I think it's 50-50. I feel that when we were at Playtech, we were asked to try and model this and come up with reasons as to why some slots are more successful than others. I think we came to the conclusion that we could probably try and explain 50% of it through, as you say, like, is it an established theme? Is it like DC Comics? Is it something that people play? You know, was it positioning in the lobby? Its longevity, how long it's been around, the math profile, for example, its volatility. There were definitely things that, you know, you could model and say, okay, we think X of the revenue is contributed by this factor. But then there was like 50% was like, we just don't know. And it could be, you know, for all those reasons you explained, Michael. So I feel it's kind of 50% kind of art, 50% sort of math and model. And, you know, so a lot of people have the Megaways mechanic because it sort of increases the pay lines by, you know, hundreds of thousands, and it makes it exciting. It changes things up. The cluster pays is an interesting mechanic. But then, you know, look at crash games. Aviator dominates that sector, even though everyone's come up with alternatives. It's still the one that, you know, grosses the most revenue. And you know, there are lots of people have tried to explain why that is. It's simplistic graphic. It was one of the first. It kind of grew in the crypto casinos. It's just had some nice elements to it. And then it became a bit of a cult game that everyone was then pushing, all the operators put it in their lobby and promoted it. So it's probably a combination of things that makes it very hard for anyone to usurp Aviator as the best crash game out there. So yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's a combination of things.
Yeah, and then we immediately come back to understandability, right? You know, can't describe it verbally, you know, because also, like you said, with the games, you know, for example, RTP and volatility are interconnected. You know, I can't have one without the other. And, you know, same with a lot of other features. It's, you know, multicollinear, nonlinear, etc. You can't put it into words. So again, here you could probably train, you know, an agent, you know, or something, or an AI to, you know, calibrate the mechanics to receive, you know, the respective output. But do you think like that operators, I mean, do they manipulate like game mechanics while playing in order to sort of come up with the best calibration, or can't they do that because GLI or whoever certifies the games? Or do you think they manipulate RTP volatility on the fly just to see, you know, what works best?
Having left Playtech 4 years ago, I don't know. I mean, I think you have to probably, whatever the RTP is advertised at, you probably have to ensure that.
Because, I mean, in reality, you could manipulate the game on the fly and see what works best, you know?
Which you could, image, as long as it meets theme, its,
you know,
RTP, you're criteria. Right. So, yeah, you're right. You can have two games with the same RTP, but massively different playing experiences, and whether they do manipulate that or not on the fly, I don't know, to be honest. But you could. I feel like as long as you're meeting the, you know, within the boundaries of how you calculate RTP and how the regulator calculates it, you probably could change things up. You know, change some of the mechanics or the volatility based on how people play. So it, yeah, but whether that actually happens, I don't know.
But you think about that in terms of somebody showing problematic gambling behaviors, and you can actually steer them away from the high volatility or whatever it is that appears to have been changing this, and use it as a tool to look after said player.
That's an interesting argument, John. I've sort of in the past proposed that to regulators, and it's got a lukewarm response, which is like, oh, well, this person is showing some signs of risk, so you're not stopping them, but you're just giving them another game to play that you think is less risky. Oh, I'm not sure about that. Maybe you need to, like, be a bit more. But I'm with you on it, John, because I feel like it's a sophisticated way of, you know, trying to change the one of the things we were really interested in GSI was, like, if you're a casual player, and you have small deposits, why market games that are high volatility that will drain your wallet very quickly? Kind of doesn't really make sense, does it? It's kind of you're gonna have a very low session RTP, you're gonna have a poor experience, and you're gonna get a deposit, you know, you're gonna get a nudge to deposit more because your balance would have been, you know, So I'm with you on it, but it might be just too sophisticated an argument to put to a regulator.
Thing is, right, so back when I was seeing all of the new physical slots, all the land-based slots, I'd always get people saying, they'd show me the machine or whatever, or they'd show me the new cabinet, the new games, and they'd say, yeah, players really love our maths model. And I'd say, no, they don't. They all they're recognizing is how often it hits. Is the bonus game enjoyable? That's it. They're not sitting there thinking about maths. They're recognizing some really basic shit, which you're manipulating to keep them sat there. And that can be used. That can be used for both sides of that coin. And it's nobody is playing a game and consciously thinking about mathematics, unless you're a game mathematician.
I also believe that to be true. You know, players have no idea about what the RTP even is, or it's about, you know, how
or they're misunderstanding what RTP means.
Yeah, I mean, even you know, educated people. Like, if you go to a gambling conference with people from the industry, and I draft a quiz for them, I'm pretty sure very few would get it right, because you know, even you could imagine, because let's say you gamble, okay, and then what's happening is the typical case is that you deposit whatever £500. And you generated a total revenue of whatever 10,000, and in the end you are broke. Okay, you know what I mean? Well, you know, you still might have a super RTP there because you have won, of course, occasionally, but in the end you still lost everything. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The RTP doesn't mean, okay, it pays you back. You go home with 5% of what you deposited. Because somebody might believe, I deposit 500, the RTP is 5%. So this means that, you know, I go home with 25. Not the case.
Not the case. People don't understand that.
You go home with zero.
It's so odd that RTP is like just...
Yeah, I don't know.
How
did this come to be, you know? I mean, of course, you know, let's say if you have a game with a very low event frequency like the lottery, okay? So the national lottery or in lottery as a weekly or bi-weekly draw, of course a person can go crazy and buy tickets all over, you know, although that's just bi-weekly draw. And what's the RTP of the lottery? 50%, right? So what do? They collect £1 billion, 500 million they pocket, 500 million they give back. I mean, there is no better business model, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's no better business model than this. And it's RTP of 50%. And then, you know, before somebody would argue, but this is super, you know, I mean, but then you could argue, shit me, I mean, I play the slots, I have an RTP of 95. I mean, you know what I mean? It is a much better because I get 95% back and you only give me 50% back. You know what I mean? But with the lottery, okay, you just play twice a week. And with the slots, you play 1,000 games an hour. You know, the RTP top metric is completely useless, I would say.
It's actually, and I think it's an input in the Asterisk model that assesses gamers that a lot of people are using in the Netherlands. I think a higher RTP is
It doesn't make any
worse.
Sense.
You
it's
kind
worse.
Of get penalized,
yeah.
Which I find a bit odd. One of the things Sarah and I were really trying to push was this idea of like game labeling. This idea that you move away from like publishing the RTP, but you actually, like the video game system has done with PEGI, you kind of describe the elements in a way that can try and explain to you what you're going to get out of the game. You know, does it have features that can, okay, in the UK they banned it, but you know, buy a bonus or speed if you can visually display this and educate people and say this game's going to give me this. These kind of elements of excitement or these elements of risk, you know, you're more likely to engage the consumer and get them to understand what they're paying for. And you know, they're going to have a better experience because they're kind of going into it with a bit more knowledge.
Maybe it's partly a communication failure as well. Maybe RTP is just actually a misleading phrase. And I've just come up with a new one. We should call it RTSPOO. Or RTS poo, return to some player or other.
Yeah. I'm sure ChatGPT did that for you.
No, I did all by myself. ChatGPT doesn't have an imagination like mine.
Yeah, it's a technical, you know, licensing condition. It's not no meaning to the player, and I feel there's a huge missed opportunity. Look at the US; they've been trying to. You know, iCasino or online slots casino is just not expanding because nobody's innovating or trying to, you know, come up with new ways of positioning the product. It's just like, oh, there's a black market and you're missing out on tax revenues. And no one cares. You know, why are they not trying to be much more creative about how they position the product and allay all the fears around, you know, addiction, problem gambling, harms, and say, look, we're going to do it in a way that's, purely around entertainment, education, all the safety measures. No one's really doing that. I don't think that. I know Jen Shatley's been at Roga for a year or so, and it takes time to do stuff. But I feel like, again, the industry there is just like totally uncreative in how it's trying to expand its product. It's just not working.
Yeah, but that's very specific also to the gambling industry, right? Because you have slot. And like with the labeling that you mentioned before, I mean, the slots are so similar with respect to all the elements, and they all gravitate literally to the same mechanic, except the theme is different, you know, isn't it? It's all very animated, very chaotic. And I mean, even I, you know, when I sit down on a slot machine, I have no idea what's happening there. I just press a button and something's happening, isn't it? You know, I mean, at the end of the day, everything else is anyway illusion of control. You even, like you say, if you were able to freeze the wheels or freeze the screen, it don't mean anything. You know, you press the button, some random, you know, number generator produces an outcome, and you win or you lose, or you win even worse. For me, the worst is when you win less than you wagered, like the winnings that's lost disguised as losses, right?
Yeah,
you place $5. It's an insult, right? And they give you one. What? I mean, I didn't win anything. I lost four.
I mean, wins below the stake is an important mechanic in slots, because it can extend play and you can make that volatility game. So I get it. It's really, you're right. It's winning when it's disguised as a win. And I know that they've handled that in the UK, and it's seen as a poor mechanic generally, that players are a bit more sophisticated. The one I love is with Aviator is the fact, the cash out. It's basically spin stops on steroids, because with a crash game, you're forced to cash out. You have to stop. You have to press a button on every round. But it has a fixed RTP. So in the long run, you cannot affect the RTP, but you're forced to make a decision on every round. Now, it's a beautiful mechanic. It's brilliant. It's genius. But in the definition of the regulations of Outlaw and spin stops, you know, I'm surprised it's around.
I have to research a bit these crash games.
Yeah, no, they're Aviator is a genius game. You know, hats off to the creator. It's really good. It's a really enjoyable game as well to play. But I feel that, again, it's classic industry innovation where they've carved out a niche that is not defined in the regulations. But actually, people like it. So what's the point of banning a game that's popular and people like?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is very, very clever, and it's not the kind of game that you want to drive underground.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
It's a game that popular would take people with it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the problem the regulator has, is if you start banning and stopping stuff, it goes underground and people find it. Very easy to find these days. So you need to be, I think, much more creative about how you regulate these products and put the safety measures on.
I think, you know, we're seeing this in real time right now. Sweeps casinos in the US and all the cease and desist letters. And it's like, I keep coming back to the same thing. And the AGA, I think, has done a horrible job with this. The AGA keeps saying these illegal operators, they're not illegal. If they're illegal, right, they're real easy to shut down.
Exactly.
So instead of forcing them off, instead of going into this heavy-handed, bring them in. Get them regulated, because there's nothing illegal about what they're doing.
No, you're
right. It makes all sorts of other things problematic.
It's like prediction markets is the new sweepstakes, isn't it, in sports betting. It's like, you know, it's kind of...
That's willful ignorance. That's not quite the same thing. That's a government that doesn't want to face the fact that actually neither side of the coin, the CTFC nor regulators, is large enough, funded enough, has the right kind of oversight. It's the way that the states are set up. It's the way federal law works. There's a lot of things acting against the gambling industry in this, and a lot of things where government, the CTFC, could be saying, actually, we just need to sort of clarify this. And, you know, the guy heading up CTFC, being a Kalshi board member and all of that, it's not a good look. But I do think, I still say they should have all along just said to Sweeps, come on in, because it's a completely different kind of player. Different kind of player. These are not iCasino players. These are not casino visitors. These are casual games players. And they're smart players. They're not stupid. They will happily go offshore and play these things. And they've missed an absolutely golden opportunity to raise tax revenue, to increase player protection in a completely, completely unserved sector of players. They've just completely missed the boat on it, and it just feels it was reactionary. It's very often the way that this industry reacts to new technology. They're like, oh shit, it's got to be shut down, it's not us.
Yeah, no, that's it's a really interesting perspective that they could have brought them in and sort of increased the pie and as you say, layered in all the good compliance.
You can't influence them. You can't influence them once you shut the conversation down.
Yeah.
It's like The Guardian in the UK when it said, right, we're not going to have any gambling advertising because blah, blah, blah. And I just said to somebody at The Guardian, we've completely fucked it. You can't, all you are now is somebody complaining about gambling. You could have changed it. You could have said you can advertise with us if you do this, 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 and this.
And what's wrong with advertising gambling? You know, it's a
oh,
it's a legal
especially
product.
When they still advertise the lottery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the lottery, yeah. I mean, one of the things, Michael, I was going to ask around lotteries, I mean, you have lottery customers. Mm-hmm. Do you find it much, do you see the distinction that, you know, lottery play is so different from all other forms of gambling that they have a point that it should be treated differently? Or is your view that, no, it's actually gambling and it needs to be treated the same?
Well, I mean, it comes down to structural characteristics at the end of the day, you know. And here, of course, the difference is extreme between a draw game. And I mean, when you talk about lottery, we mostly talk about draw games, where you would have a draw once a day or twice a week or once a week, you know. And with such a low event frequency, the risk, you know, like Mark said, you know, there hasn't been a single known case of a person exclusively addicted to the lottery, right? You know, they play other things too. They might also play the lottery, but it's just this extremely low event frequency. On the other hand, of course, when we talk about games as such, scratch cards, online scratch cards, they are very similar to the slots with respect to structural characteristics. What many lotteries do is, I mean, they have very low, voluntarily or regulatorily like limits, just like, you know, the forced national lottery license in the UK. A person simply can't, you know, spend more than a very low amount of money in a short period of time. And that business model works simply because you have such a large pool of potential customers. Because there's just one lottery in a country, like in the UK, and, you know, you have so many potential customers, that was what allows you to have such a, you know, uniformly distributed gambling, you know, cohort, because you don't have players, can't have players who spend thousands, and on the other hand, you have a few who are spending a couple of cents, and that's the difference. But it comes down to structural characteristics, you know. I mean, like Mark says, okay, you can do a very addictive lottery, you just make a draw every 5 seconds, then it's a slot, you know. If I would, or every 5 seconds, you know, draw six balls out of 45 numbers, you know, I have a slot. Simply the case.
Yeah.
But okay, the business model, of course it's gambling, right? It's gambling, but then, you know, but the event frequency is so low. But then if you made a slot and you can only spin the slot once a week, it's not a slot anymore, isn't it? I mean, nobody would play it. Completely boring.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, the event frequency always comes up as the factor, doesn't it? Which is why sports betting is kind of in the optics of regulators, because, you know, with AI and technology now, you can create, thousands, 1,500, according to Sportradar, betting opportunities per tennis match. So, which makes it more, it's kind of the casinification, the single game parlays, where you start creating lottery or casino-like products based on combinations of sports outcomes, or you have lots of events happening next pitch, next bowl, next serve. So this was something that I thought about a lot. Is the industry creating these because people want them, or is it creating them because it can? And I feel it's a bit of both, where,
there are cases, for example, in Finland, right? A couple of years ago, they removed thousands of slot machines. Thousands, okay? They just, shut down a couple of, one branch of the business. The, governmentally sort of owned the company there. And nothing happened. Like, literally nothing happened. People didn't increasingly play online. They didn't increasingly play, frequent the other slot arcades. They didn't, switch to the offshore market. They just stopped doing it. You know what I mean? Often that's also happening, surely, a small fraction, and if you look at the prevalence rate, especially for casino playing, those are very few people comparably, right? Who are drawn by this type of product. It's not like, that every second person out there, feels the need to play the casino, the online casino or something like this. And often, you remove this product from the market and it doesn't even, make waves at all,
I think they've done that in Sweden, haven't they? They've shut down all the casinos, physical casinos now, haven't they? And because I don't know whether that's resulted in an uptick in online, but I know that they're not offering them anymore. But no, I think it's interesting, a sort of innovation in the industry that, there's more betting opportunities, but, is it necessarily increasing harms or population harm? Some will argue it is, and, just you've got to suppress the gambling opportunities, and others will say it's just competing for share of attention and mind in a digital world, where if they're not on our sports betting app watching the tennis and placing the odd bet, they're going to be on Netflix or on a gaming app or doing something else online. So
exactly, there's lots of alternative opportunities to spend your time much more, and it's increasing. Jonathan, how are we doing time-wise?
We're absolutely killing it.
Do I need to get to the chopper?
we do actually need to leave by helicopter.
Get down!
John, you used to be somebody I could trust.
I don't know when. Yes, Simo, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate both the recordings that we've done so far for Addiction and Hour with Hour have been over an hour, so I like to think we're giving value for money.
People have to pay. You didn't tell me that.
Well, no, it's just an expression, isn't it? Like, okay. RTP, it doesn't actually mean anything. Unlike RTS Poo.
RTS Poo is a good one, yeah.
I'm going to work on that, and I'm going to try and get it to catch on in the industry.
Yeah.
And if I don't hear people saying RTS Poo at ICE, I failed.
You could be on something there. There's definitely a... It's kind of... There's a truth to it.
I've always said, if there's only some way I could get paid to just think shit up, maybe next year. Simo, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Is this uploaded now or what? Or
I haven't pressed stop yet. Fucking hell, calm down.